I'm Tyler Sutton. I'm president of the Grassland Foundation. And this is the third annual Grassland Foundation lecture in grassland conservation and sustainable communities. I have several thank yous, but I want to try to get through this relatively quickly so that we can turn the program over to our speaker, Chris Weaver. But I do need to take care of a couple housekeeping matters. First of all, we were very pleased to get some funding this year from the Nebraska Humanities Council. And if you haven't signed in out there, that would be nice if you would do that. And then after the program, there was an evaluation sheet on your chair. So we'd appreciate if you would fill that out. But I also wanted to thank, in particular, Dr. Jim Stubendick, who's the and his staff, the director of the Center for Great Plains Studies, Dr. Martin Massengill, the director of the Center of Grassland Studies, Don Mackey, who's the director of the Rupri Center for Rural Entrepreneurship, Don Montagna, who runs the Economic Conservation Program at the World Wildlife Fund in Bozeman, Jim Douglas, the director of the Wildlife Division. He's some sort of administrator out there at Nebraska Game and Parks. Mary Yeager, who helped us with the grant at the Nebraska Humanities Council. I also need to acknowledge the financial support of the UNL Senate, Faculty Senate Convocation Fund. Some of you, I think, have been to previous lectures. The purpose of our annual lecture is to explore topics that relate to grassland conservation and the sustainability of the human communities. This year, like we've done in previous years, we'll have an opening presentation and then seek questions and hopefully have a discussion. The presentation will be approximately 50 minutes to an hour, leaving about a half hour for questions, and I'll moderate that. You may recall a couple years ago, our first presentation was by the director of the Quivira Coalition, which is from New Mexico, and they work on improving land health through cattle grazing, as well as building bridges between the urban and ranching community on issues relating to wildlife and grazing in New Mexico. We felt it was important to start the series because we thought they were doing some interesting things with cattle ranchers and we wanted to highlight it. We agree as an organization that with those that claim that cattle ranching is the foundation of the economy in most grassland areas of the Northern Great Plains, including Nebraska, and that the profitability of cattle ranching is essential to the conservation of those grasslands and the economic well-being of the region. That said, most of our focus has been on work relating to multiple and entrepreneurial uses of grazing lands for a couple reasons. First, there are established institutions, the Extension Service and other, that have addressed the cattle grazing issues, at least historically. But we also thought that multiple uses of private grazing lands made economic and conservation sense, and so that strategies related to that are something that we thought that that we should work on. Last year, we took a step back when we invited Larry Swanson, a former Nebraskan, to give the second annual lecture. He's a regional economist now at the University of Montana. And we wanted to look at the evidence on economics and demographics to sort of get a picture of the challenges ahead in rural areas on the Northern Great Plains in terms of their economic future and how multiple uses of private grazing lands might fit into a new or slightly different vision for use of those grasslands into the future. And it was interesting, while he's not a conservation expert by any stretch of the imagination, I think one of the conclusions that Larry reached was that where appropriate, where there was local support, communities might want to look to strategies involving conservation uses of lands, uses that involve hunting and wildlife viewing and horseback riding and those sorts of things. So this year we intend to build on those previous presentations by asking our speaker to address the public policy and market-driven changes that have precipitated significant growth in both wildlife and economic activity in a country halfway around the globe, Namibia. And at first blush, it may seem somewhat odd that we would look to there for ideas and things to draw on, but the presentation, I think you'll see in a few minutes, while it's up to you to draw your own conclusions, I think it's relevant. And I can say that in part because through the help of the World Wildlife Fund, last year a small group of Nebraskans traveled to Namibia on a study tour to study how they are managing wildlife and their livestock and cattle enterprises. And one of the things that I think we all came, or several of the things that we came away with was that Namibians are incredibly hospitable and friendly. Country's beautiful, has incredible open space and wildlife. And it was somewhat surprising to me that the tourism standards there, the infrastructure, level of guiding, those sorts of things, have extremely high standards. And it was really a pleasure to be there. And we also observed that in much of the central part of the country, this tourism industry coexists with cattle ranching. In thinking about that, we came away, you know, believing that there were things to learn there, and since it would be somewhat impractical to take everybody here there, the next best thing is we thought we'd bring the person that we believe to know more about it here, and that's going to be our speaker, Chris Weaver, who's the director of the World Wildlife Fund's program in Namibia. Chris is an American. He went to college in Arizona. He received an undergraduate degree in range management, a master's degree in range ecology from the University of Arizona. He has nearly 25 years of experience working on agriculture, rural development, and wildlife projects in southern Africa. But prior to his international postings, he began his professional career in the southern states, or in the southwest, Arizona and New Mexico, where he engaged in a variety of natural resource inventory planning management activities. His clients there included the Bureau of Land Management, U.S. Forest Service, private ranchers, corporate entities, and Native American tribes. He began his overseas career in the early 1980s in the southern African country of Lesotho as an employee of a private consulting firm, American Ag International. He started out as a range field specialist, eventually working his way up to various leadership positions in range in agricultural projects. But in 1993, he was hired by the World Wildlife Fund and based in Namibia as the director of the USAID-funded LIFE project and continues in that role today. Since arriving in Namibia, he has been instrumental in helping to establish and develop what are known as communal conservancies, and he'll talk more about that in his talk, including developing anti-poaching programs, democratic governance structures, tourism infrastructure, and the facilitation of linkages with private sector partners in tourism and the sport hunting industry. He's also participated in various aspects of developing national policy in areas of range management, conservation, tourism, land tenure, livestock production, and rural development. In 2004, he was awarded the Conservationist of the Year Award by the Namibian Professional Hunting Association. In 2006, he was given the World Wildlife Fund Award for Conservation Excellence, which is given annually to one member of the WWF staff in the African program for exceptional conservation performance on the African continent. His talk today is entitled Wildlife and Sustainable Rural Development in Namibia, Other Applications to the Northern Great Plains? Please join me in welcoming Chris Weaver.
Thank you, Tyler. That was a very nice introduction. And I'd like to say from my side that it's really great to be here. The people in Lincoln are incredibly hospitable. Had the pleasure of being a guest last night at a function hosted by Joel and Tyler. And people are very warm, friendly, and hospitable. And I contrast that to when I go to Washington, D.C. I probably dodge more cars on a daily basis going to the office between the hotel and the WWF office than they have in the country of Namibia. And so I find that really stressful, and I find coming here very, very enjoyable. And I also find it quite intriguing to be able to look back at our program, to be able to share our experiences with you, because I have to look at it from a different set of eyes when I present this to you. So what I would like to do to start off is to move the cover of that. And as Tyler indicated, the title of my program and presentation is Wildlife and Sustainable Rural Development in Namibia, Are There Applications to the Great Plains, the Northern Great Plains? And this is based upon 15 years of experience that we've had working in Namibia, a number of key partners in the program in terms of how we do our work and how we assist. WWF is who I work for. The middle logo there is the Ministry of Environment and Tourism, which is the equivalent of your Game and Parks here in Nebraska. NACSO, which is the Namibian Association of CBNRM Service Organizations, which is a civil society group of about 14 NGOs that we support through the conservation program we operate in Namibia. And then one individual NGO, which is a little dark, just difficult to see on that dark background, the Namibia Nature Foundation. And they're included specifically in here, even though they're a member of NACSO, because a lot of the data in here is a result of their research and their work on the private lands. I have a number of different points that I'd like to discuss and cover in the presentation. One of them starting off giving a little bit of setting and context of Namibia. It might be a little bit odd to compare Namibia with the Great Plains states, and I think that Tyler's really picked up on some very interesting comparable types of programs and initiatives that might have applicability here. So I'll lay a little bit of context for that before we start going into the meat of the program. But then I want to talk a little bit about the shifting paradigms that we have in Namibia. Very much like the Great Plains states, Namibia was a cattle country, production-based, and we're going more and more toward a service industry based around wildlife and tourism. So there's a real shift in the paradigm and the mindsets of policymakers and rural development there. Some of the different models that we use there in Namibia, we'll go through and highlight a few of those. The changing trends that we're seeing in economic performance and productivity indices in Namibia. Some of the lessons learned we've learned through this process, conclusions, and then end up with a few questions that maybe are just food for thought for the group on how what we're doing in Namibia might be able to be applicable here in the Great Plains states, and in particular, maybe Nebraska. And so I think that some of the things might be a far stretch, some of the things might not be such a far stretch. For those of you that aren't aware of where Namibia is, it's in the southwestern corner of Africa. South Africa's to the south of us, Botswana to the east, and Angola to the north. And we have the Atlantic Ocean with a very cold coastal zone on the west. The size of the country, 317,000 square miles, a population of roughly 2 million people, And that puts us as the second least densely populated country in the world behind Mongolia, with about 6.2 people per square mile. In terms of size, if you look at Nebraska, North Dakota, South Dakota, and Wyoming, we're about the same size as those four states combined. Population-wise, those four states also are some of the least densely populated states in the U.S. So I think there are a lot of wide open spaces and a lot of comparable issues related to that. Namibia, in contrast to Nebraska, but maybe similar to some other places in the Great Plains, 43% private land, 41% communal land, and about 14 to 16% state land. And that state land comes in the form of protected area parks or tourism concession areas or mining leases. Namibia is quite an arid country. It has limited production potential because of the aridness and semi-aridness. The western zones are desert. We get rainfall 100 to 200 millimeters in this western zone of Namibia, and that rainfall increases as you move eastward. That western zone is not very productive for any type of land-based agricultural production. As you move eastward into the arid zones and start getting to your savanna grasslands, it becomes a little bit more marginal for livestock production and a little more marginal for crop production as you go east from there, until you get to the far northeast up there. But the bottom line is that from an agricultural perspective, Namibia has limitations in terms of its rainfall, its precipitations, and the soils. Yet it has been traditionally a very strong livestock-producing country. In terms of historical development, Namibia and southern Africa very much paralleled the historical settlement patterns of the United States, being initially settled in the early 1600s and then having an expansion of people in their ox wagons from the south to the north. The land was originally very rich in wildlife, great diversity, your megafauna and your other smaller species as well. But our wildlife populations have degraded and eroded through the years as that land was converted from non-inhabited to more agricultural production by sedentary populations of people. We had a peak of our livestock populations in early 1900s, but then we had a crash of those when the drought came. We had drought in Namibia the same years as the Midwestern U.S. suffered from the droughts. And then we've had a slow recovery of those populations until the 1960s when we started this conversion from livestock production over toward more of a wildlife and indigenous biodiversity type of production. The nature of how people perceived wildlife in the 1960s is captured in that last statement there. In many cases, the attitude of people toward wildlife is that they were vermin and pest, and farms were actually being sold as guaranteed wildlife-free. That was the attitude in the 1960s of people toward the presence of wildlife. Okay, Namibia also is a very diverse country. This is the southern part of Namibia, the Namib Brand, where Tyler and a group of people had the opportunity to come and visit last year. Spectacular desert setting with red sand dunes. This is the coastal zone where we get hundreds of thousands of flamingos breeding on a seasonal basis. More your savanna grasslands in the midland areas, ranging up to one of our few rivers in the country, the Kanini River, and the Apupa Falls on the Angola border. So there's a lot of spectacular landscapes and a lot of diversity, and there's a very rich and abundant wildlife base with a range of plains game species, and we also have what Africa terms the Big Five, which is your elephant, your rhino, your buffalo, and your leopard. And Those particular animals, again, similar to here in North America and Europe, very few of those are actually found on private land anymore. Those animals are largely found in the park system and in the communal lands where we're working with local communities to enhance the value of wildlife as a sustainable rural development strategy. The country's seen a lot of change. Prior to 1990, Namibia was one of the two countries in southern Africa that was managed under an apartheid regime where black Namibian citizens had very few rights and had very little control over their future destinies, but were basically dependent on very meager services that were being provided by government. With the independence in 1990, that was abolished, a constitution was developed, and Namibia is one of the few, if not the only country in the world, where conservation of its environment is actually built into the constitution as a mandate for the country. Another change that has happened is that with the independence, there was a need to readdress what are the development objectives of the country. And one of the decisions that was made out of that process was to look at ourselves within Namibia and say, what are the comparative advantages that we have as a country? And how can we use them to make us more competitive with our neighboring countries or other places around the globe so that we can be more functional and viable as a country? Has a rapidly evolving economy with major changes taking place, growth in the mining industry, which is number one in the GDP, but tourism is now number two in the GDP, and that's a result of the wildlife recovery and the changes that are taking place there. Ocean fisheries and agriculture has dropped to number four, and that's quite a drop compared to when the country was independent in 1990. And then last of all, it's considered by many people around the world to have one of the most dynamic conservation and development type approaches and systems where it really engages community members in benefiting from the presence of wildlife and the resources that wildlife are dependent upon. So one of the comparative advantages of Namibia, that might be comparable to here in the Great Plains. We've got wide open spaces. And in Namibia's case, we also have a lot of wilderness that's untouched, and that's a very valuable commodity in today's world. We have abundant biodiversity and diverse wildlife populations, and they have a lot of value given the types of habitat that they're raised in and the marketability of that in the tourism world. We have uncontaminated meat and fish products that are raised off of native rangelands or produced in the oceans there that compare with anywhere in the world. We have tremendously rich cultural diversity. We have 14 different tribal groups. We have Afrikaans, German, English speaking, and we have 26 different languages spoken in the country. So that in itself is a unique attribute. And then lastly, compared to most African countries, we have very efficient services. Communication is very good. Road infrastructure is good. Accommodations are very good, health. So it's very attractive to visiting tourists coming to the area. So one of the things that, once we figured out what the comparative advantages were, is how do you go about unlocking those so you can take advantage of them to your benefit? And so a number of steps that were involved in that process. One of them being given recognition to the environmental limitations that we have, the arid to semi-arid production regime, the low capability for livestock or crops. Another one being that if we were going to make changes, that we might have to make some adjustments in our policy environment, our legislative environment. And then we also needed different mechanisms to get the message and the systems across that allowed that unlocking to take place and for the people living with the resources be able to benefit from those resources. And so we're going to go through some of these different mechanisms like freehold conservancies, communal conservancies, public-private partnerships, and then private reserves. those are all pretty widespread now as different mechanisms that promote both conservation and rural development in Namibia. And then lastly, one of the things that changed over the years since independence is a concerted marketing effort by private sector, by government, by a variety of different stakeholders, making the global world aware of the values and the uniqueness of Namibia, trying to attract a greater number of tourists or people from the outside to come and visit the country or come and invest in the country. This particular graph, I'm going to play with this a little bit, is something from a hypothetical perspective we believe is appropriate for Namibia's arid, semi-arid climate. And on the left side there you have the benefits, and on the bottom you have rainfall. And rainfall increases as you go across the axis to the right. And we have a hypothesis that given the arid nature of the country, that your indigenous biodiversity can actually generate greater benefits than your exotic species. So an oryx and a springbok that doesn't have to have water in order to exist and maybe will move 20 or 30 kilometers to follow the rainfall pattern is much more adapted to that environment than a cow that has to come back to water every day and maybe only grazes 2 or 3 miles around that particular water. But then we also believe that as you move away from that process and you get into higher rainfall and more productive areas, that your indigenous species no longer is as productive as your exotic species. And if you take, for example, North America or you take Europe, you have a lot of cattle species that are not indigenous but are developed and produced there because they're much more productive in going to the market. And they produce more beef. Or you have crops that are adapted and have been cultivated and refined through the years and they're planted on the lands. So that land might be more effectively used for agricultural production. But what we've had in Namibia's case also is that we have policy interventions that historically drove down the value of wildlife. There was ownership issues, rights issues, where government was the benefactor from the wildlife. Government got all the income, and the wildlife were seen as pests. Similarly, now with the meat trade for beef going to Europe, there are huge veterinary restrictions imposed upon wildlife that prevent the wildlife from reaching their full value from an economic perspective. And so we recognized that there were policy issues that had to be addressed there in order to overcome some of those existing policies that were suppressing the value of wildlife. And we also recognized that there are agricultural subsidies that are artificially driving up the value of your agricultural products that make them competitive with your wildlife, even when wildlife might be more competitive on a normal free market situation. And so I think that's a common feature of many governments around the world, is that they want to be as independent as possible, and they want to promote self-subsistence on their own food products and not have to import. So you get a number of subsidies that promote agriculture as a land use, when in some cases that might not even be the most appropriate land use for that particular type of land. So Namibia dealt with this process. Starting in 1967, there were some visionaries within the conservation program that recognized that if private landowners didn't start benefiting from their wildlife, there was going to be more and more of this situation where people were decimating the wildlife and selling their farms as wildlife free. And so they made a decision at that time to devolve conditional ownership rights to the landowner, which then they anticipated would give them or provide them with the incentives to put wildlife back on their land and manage it as a part of their livelihood strategies. So Namibia created 3 different categories of game, one of them being what we call huntable species. And these are your very common species like springbok, kudu, oryx, and warthog, which would be very comparable here to, say, a white-tailed deer. They're that common. And then they had a second category of game, which they call protected species. And these are your more valuable species like roan, sable, sesame, giraffe. And that might be more comparable to an elk or a bighorn sheep here in the U.S. And then we have what we call specially protected species. And these are species of global significance because they're endangered, and they might be things like elephants and black and white rhino. And so Namibia categorized these different species of animals, and they gave strong rights over to the common species, and they gave rights of income and benefits to the other species as well, the protected and the especially protected. And that has worked extremely well. I'll give you some figures on how the wildlife numbers have responded over the last 40 years as a result later on in here, but it has succeeded. And now that model was emulated for the communal areas, the areas that we work in with our WWF program, in 1996, when those same rights were given to communities that are living on the communal lands. And in addition to the huntable game and the other game and the game products, they were given the rights to commercial tourism because private sector on private land didn't need those rights. So they already had them by just owning the land versus in the communal areas, they had to acquire those rights because there was no legitimate body in order to have those rights as individual entities. Some of the different mechanisms that we're using to promote improved conservation and rural development are the freehold conservancies. These are the conservancies on private land, and I'll talk about them a little bit in our next graph, but this would be very comparable to the lands that you have here in Nebraska where you have ranches and you have people with wildlife on them. In our case in Namibia, they're farms, and our farms are roughly about 12,500 acres in size as an average in the central areas, and they get up to about 20,000 acres in the southern areas. Then we also have communal conservancies, and this is going at it from the other extreme where you have no land tenure ownership, the land's vested in the state, and this was a mechanism created in order to give the tribal communities living on their land the rights to their wildlife. Then you have public-private partnerships. This is where your partnerships between private sector and your park system. And then you have private nature reserves like the Namib Ran that was visited by a group of people from here in the past. The freehold conservancies, they started forming shortly after independence. This is a little bit of a map showing what there are 23 of them now. They cover include about 415 farm members, cover about 3.5 million hectares, which 3.5 million hectares is about 8.5 million acres. So it's a good chunk of land. And these have basically been formed by people collectivizing their resources because they recognize that the scale of management and economic development as a single farm is not competitive. And it's not a biological unit for wildlife species that need to move through larger areas. So you end up with clusters. Each one of these little blocks is a farm, you can see. And they merge together because they've joined their resources together. They have basically a contract, a constitutional type contract between the different farms that live in the area, the different landowners, and they make decisions on how they're going to manage the wildlife in that area. They set their quotas for hunting offtake jointly as a group of people. If they want to sell live game on the live game market, they make decisions how they're going to do that. They market jointly to create an identity for themselves and a brand for themselves as what makes them unique in Namibia as a particular conservancy. And it becomes a good management tool for bringing together clusters of farms that then can manage their resources as in a holistic manner. Now, the communal conservancies are the opposite in terms of they had no rights, the people living on these lands, and they didn't have the private land and the rights to that land like the private landowners did, but they had no mechanism in order to acquire the rights because there were no boundaries around the areas in which they were attempting to manage their wildlife. So in order to form a communal conservancy, the government said you need to have a constitution, you have to have agreed upon boundaries with your neighbors on where you're working and what you call your conservancy, you have to have a management plan, and you have to have a membership. And this program has proven to be very popular. The first one's formed in 1998. And since 1998, we've been able to register 50 of them. The 50 conservancies cover 11.8 million hectares, which is equivalent to about 29 million acres. And they involve a large number of people. And what you see here is what's happening in the communal conservancies as a result of policy changes that were made back here in late 96, and then moving forward to the first conservancies registering in 98, and you now have a situation where you have escalating income that's been unlocked as a result of the policy interventions that government made to devolve rights to the wildlife down to the landowner. And in this case, it's communal conservancies. And this graph basically portrays in the tan area the cash income, the employment income, and then the in-kind benefits. And most of those in-kind benefits are actually meat now that's being harvested on a sustainable basis for community members. So this, for 2007, communities are basically receiving about $5 million U.S. dollars from this investment. And private sector is getting about $16 to $18 million out of this investment. And that program has become extremely popular. This is a graph that portrays the participation level by community residents. We now have about 220,000 people participating in the program, and that is about one out of eight Namibian citizens. And so there aren't many countries in the world where you can say that one out of eight citizens are involved in conservation activities that are also promoting their development and their livelihoods. The public-private partnerships, we have a large number of parks in Namibia. They tend to be very big in size because of the arid to semi-arid environment that the parks are found in. Historically, these parks were all fenced, and that created major problems for wildlife. In that when your rains don't come, your wildlife move to the east, and they seek the moister areas of the country or where the rainfall is, which tends to be more to the east. And when they come up to that fence line where the park is, then they cluster up against that fence line, and often they die because there's just nowhere to go. There's no food, there's no water. And so what's now happening is we have some very good private sector initiatives where the parks and the private farms around the parks, they've dropped the fences. The game moves between the fences. The tourism opportunities have been promoted jointly between the parks and the private sector. Branding exercises that benefit both the parks and the private sector. And you have enhanced economies of scale that makes all your business activities more viable. And this is an example of one of them in southern Namibia, which is around what we call the Fish River Canyon, and how all these private lands have gone from small stock production over the last 5 to 7 years now converting over to wildlife and tourism. And that's basically the vision that they're seeking there. And that's, again, promoting barrier and fence-free movements for your wildlife and your areas of high aridity. This is the particular initiative there at Godwana Nature Reserve. And I'm going to give a little bit of background and the differences on how it was, how productive it was when it was under agricultural production versus now under tourism and wildlife production. You can see here in the past, it was generating in this particular area about $15 a hectare, $15 Namibian dollars. And when it got put under tourism, it went up to 165 Namibian dollars per hectare. So you're talking about an 11-fold increase in terms of economic or financial returns. Then that's the other figure there on the left is what communal land farming on with livestock. It's more around $5 a hectare, and that tends to be more subsistence-oriented instead of commercially-oriented. This is what happened on this particular operation prior to, in terms of the employment generated, prior to becoming the nature reserve, there were less than 20 people full-time employed on this farm. And by 2003, they had over 120 full-time employments, people employed. And that's basically going from a primary production regime to a service industry type regime. And this is being emulated now across the private lands in Namibia and being picked up in the communal lands as well. So what this is all leading to is a major paradigm shift, where in the past, government policy and decision makers, they were largely thinking about how do we make agriculture more effective? How do we promote agriculture as the appropriate land use, even though it wasn't necessarily the most appropriate land use on that arid and semi-arid environment? And as more and more investments are going toward the indigenous biodiversity, the wildlife, the plants, and so forth, it's leading to a real shift in economic performance and a real shift in the mindset of your decision and policymakers, where they're becoming more and more wildlife friendly and becoming more and more adaptive to the opportunities that the indigenous biodiversity can offer. Here's some figures that were put together in 2005. This is in Namibian dollars. The Namibian dollar is about roughly 8 to 1 U.S. dollar. Cattle production is the biggest producer on the farmlands there. But you combine all these other attributes together and you get about 1.9 billion Namibian dollars there. In contrast, if you look at what's happened over the indigenous biodiversity production, the trophy hunting returns on their own, about 316 million Namibian dollars, are greater than both sheep and goat production in Namibia, which used to be one of their main sources of income and land use. Live game sales are growing. Wildlife viewing is the biggest income. People coming to the park system, coming to the private lands, to the communities, now staying at lodges, community campsites, traveling around, leaving a lot of money behind on the value chain as they do that. But this estimate showed about 3.2 billion versus a 1.8 billion. So the long and the short of that is that indigenous biodiversity production is almost outproducing agricultural production in Namibia now by a 2-to-1 margin. This is part of the transition that's taken place and some of the trends that are still ongoing. In 1971, we had 1.8 million head of cattle, 4.5 million head of small stock. As the years have passed, and this is just on the private land, this is the whole country as a whole, but the private land, by 2001, the cattle population had dropped by almost 50%, and the entire livestock population had dropped by 41%. And this was a national process that was taking place because people were replacing their livestock with wildlife. And you can see during those same years, wildlife populations increased by 262%. And this is, again, this is all on private land. This is people changing according to market opportunities and economic opportunities that they can invest in and increase their return per hectare or land unit. The major market forces that are driving this change in Namibia are the wildlife utilization. Trophy hunting is quite big in Namibia. It wasn't prior to 1990. It was very limited to almost exclusively a German market that was coming there because of the German colony connections. It's expanding rapidly. But other ways of utilizing the wildlife that have become quite important and significant is a lot of the game is harvested for meat. Any grocery store that you go into in Namibia will sell up to 8 or 10 different types of venison. Any restaurant that you go into will have 8 or 10 different types of venison on the menu, and it is a very marketable commodity. Farm workers are largely fed with venison because of the abundance of wildlife in the private lands. And then you also have a live game market where people are selling live game both within the country to restock private lands that are converting over, or in the region, South Africa or Botswana, buying some of that game. The photographic tourism, the major source of income, people coming not only to see the wildlife, but also to see the landscapes, to experience Africa, the cultural diversity. We work a lot with joint venture lodges. The private sector capitalizes the lodges, trains people how to operate them, markets them, and they're very productive. One down in the lower right-hand corner is actually a community campsite, and our community campsites, many of them are generating $50,000 to $60,000 a year, and these are going back to people that have a per capita income of about $100 a year. So the contributions toward livelihoods and rural development are quite significant. And you can see there's also quite a shift in the value of wildlife depending on the rarity of it and the charismaticness of it, how it's valued by the hunting and the tourism industry. You can go all the way up to white rhino, that exchange rate is about $20,000 US for a white rhino. Buffalo is about $17,000, $18,000 to a springbuck down at the lower end, which is about $100 US. Versus an ox is about $3,000 Namibian, about $400 US, and a goat is about $50. So there's quite a contrast between the value of wildlife on the live sell market versus livestock on the live sell market. But these figures are just indicative of what people's willingness to pay are if you can sell them. Obviously with your livestock, you have a more stable market and you have a greater demand. So that will be a market that will stay there for a long time in Namibia's case. We've seen a real transition in the tourism industry, being very much product or market-led, but as you develop your products, then you get an increasing response to the quality of the product and the service that you provide. And it just tends to escalate upward, upward, upward if you get it right. We've gone from approximately 100,000 tourists a year coming to Namibia prior to independence in 1989 to over 800,000 tourists in 2006. And roughly half of those, 40%, 50%, are nature-based tourists. So they're coming to Namibia not just to visit people or friends, but they're coming there actually to see the sights and experience the wildlife or the scenic landscapes or the outdoors. Similar to that, a subset of the tourism visitations are those that are coming for trophy hunting. These figures go back to 1994. We had about 1,800 foreign hunters come to Namibia in 1994. Versus in 2006, about 6,300. And so we've seen a massive increase as the quality of the product developed, people get more sophisticated in their marketing, the market becomes more aware of what's on offer, and then we get more and more people coming to Namibia. And these individuals are spending between $8,000 and $10,000 for each visitation. And so that's become quite a lucrative source of income for both the private sector and the communities. This is kind of a transitional slide series, the next few slides showing the change in land under conservation from independence to 2008 and the increased conservation and landscape linkages that we've been able to achieve. And this first slide is basically from 1990 to 96, looking at what happened when communal or our freehold conservancy started to form in 1991, 92, and they were taken up by the private sector. And we had those 415 farmers and roughly 3.5 million hectares under freehold conservancies. Then in 1998, we had our first four communal conservancies forming. And thereafter, we've had a number of new conservancies. The blue, the yellow ones are the new ones. In 2000, we had another one. And then in 2001, we had another one. And then the word started getting out. And by 2003, we had a bunch more. And 2005, they started to spread across even more. 2006, and this takes us up to 2008. And we have seen land under conservation-friendly management go from slightly less than 12% in 1990 to a little bit more than 38%. But from our perspective at WWF, one of the really important things is that we're getting major linkages between these parks, where we're getting flow of genetic material from lion, from elephant, from cheetah, from a lot of your rare species that under historic conditions or pre-independence conditions might have been threatened to genetic inbreeding or even population-wise. And then from the government's perspective, you have your park system, and you now have much of your park system completely bounded by wildlife-friendly conservation programs. And so not only are the communities and the private sector benefiting from this wildlife, but the government's having more viable parks. And what more viable parks mean for Namibia means that Namibia becomes more competitive as a tourist destination as well. So you end up with more and more tourists coming because of the quality of the product that's being sold and marketed in Namibia. And we basically have a very much upward spiraling situation where as your product developed and more tourists become aware of it, the quality of the service improves because you have this competitive nature there, and it just keeps going up and up. And we're still very much in the bottom part of that upward spiral circle. So it has worked very well for us. Some of the lessons we've learned in this process, one of them, foreign and or national subsidies can really affect your market values, and particularly for the wildlife. We have a case now where market values are still very much distorted by the EU subsidy to Namibia, which gives free access of livestock to the EU market, which basically means the value of your cattle are worth about 40% more than if you were selling them in Namibia or the region. So that gives you an unsustainable subsidy that is promoting an unsustainable land use compared to other competitive land uses around your indigenous biodiversity. And those subsidies that the EU put in place in turn stimulated the government to put in a lot of subsidies to promote livestock production too, in which you get free veterinary services in many places in the communal areas. You get quarantine facilities for health purposes when you're trying to export your animals from the communal areas into the freehold land. And it has stymied the productivity of the wildlife or the market value of the wildlife that's found in many of these areas too by imposing or not imposing, but creating situations where the wildlife cannot be freely marketed north of the veterinary cordon areas, and you can't get a financial value other than as an animal that's been hunted as a trophy or consumed as meat locally. Again, the policy environment, a key lesson here that we saw in that graph that I showed earlier is that you need to make policy adjustments and devolve a lot of your resource management down to your land user if you want to unlock the optimal values of your resource that you're trying to manage. And another thing that we feel is very important is that you don't want to have exploitation of your resource. You want to have a strong linkage between the resource management and the income that's being generated so that you reinvest in the management of that resource with some of your income. And as you improve your management, your resource does better and your income does better. And so you get that upward cycle again. So it's really important to have a real good linkage between benefits generated and the resources that you're trying to manage. Okay, again, harnessing values at different parts of the value chain. If we were just trying to market our wildlife resources in Namibia, we would really be cutting ourselves short. We had to look at where the different parts of the value chain and where they're located on a global basis and how can we compete and be part of that. And so you need to look beyond just the primary production of what you're trying to produce and look at secondary benefits that you can generate and spin-off activities that those may generate and then hook into those as well. Going back to that graph that I showed a little bit earlier, is that if we're going to promote conservation as a land use and wildlife and indigenous biodiversity as a land use, then it better be a competitive land use. Because no matter how much you preach to people and how much you tell them that you should have wildlife or you should promote a certain type of management practice, if it's not in their best interest as the landowner and the land manager, then they're not going to do it. They're going to do what's best for them as individuals. So in some places you want to, you know, kind of recognize that wildlife and tourism, that's not appropriate there. Other places it is. Then again, from our side in the past, Namibia, this paradigm shift, conservation was a very bad word prior to 1990. People despised their wildlife, government policymakers. In terms of the black Namibians, they grew up with elephants, they grew up with lions that killed their cattle, hyena that ate their cattle, cheetahs, leopards, buffalo, a range of animals that not only did it eat their cattle and eat their crops, but it killed their children or even killed them. And they were not able to benefit from the presence of those animals, and they were eking their living off the land on subsistence agriculture, and they actually despised, in many cases, the wildlife that they grew up with. And that's changing. Now that people get to benefit from them, a conflict animal is no longer necessarily a conflict animal. A conflict animal is something that you have to have a strategy to counter and mitigate the impacts of having that animal live there, because it actually can bring you more value from the other sources of income and benefits than by taking it away. So now we have a willingness in many of the communal areas for living with lion and living with cheetah, living with elephants, and these big, hairy, dangerous animals that were never very popular in the past. And our wildlife populations have responded tremendously as a result of that change in attitude. Some of the conclusions, the development of indigenous biodiversity production systems, particularly in an arid to semi-arid environment of Namibia or to southern Africa, can very often outperform traditional agricultural farming systems. The strongest incentive for wise and sustainable use of the wild, of a wildlife or any type of natural resource is by creating a high and tradable value for that, so it provides incentive for people to have that resource on their land to manage it effectively. The best way to operationalize incentive-based systems to managing a resource is to devolve rights to benefit and manage that resource down to the landowner. Don't try to manage it from a capital or from a regional area, and this is a big problem in Africa, but get that management down and the rights to the fruits of that management to the people living on the land. In our case, policy reform was absolutely essential in order to unlock the benefits that flow from that devolution of rights. And that's the case across all of Africa that has very much a colonialistic attitude toward wildlife, where it is all state-owned wildlife and communities are not benefiting from it. And that's why you hear all these bad stories across Africa about the annihilation of wildlife, the fragmentation and loss of their habitat, is that people have no incentive to live without wildlife. And again, by giving those benefits down and having an appropriate policy environment, that changes, it makes a world of difference. Again, that one graph that I portrayed about rural development, livelihoods, we find that this conversion over from a primary-based agricultural production or subsistence agriculture versus a service-related industry like tourism, trophy hunting, it creates much more employment opportunity. And many of our conservancies, one of the major benefits that have been listed by the conservancy members is the fact that their young kids, their young aspiring people, they're no longer leaving the area. They're not going to the city looking for a job. Instead, they're staying there with the family because now they have a job that didn't exist before this program started. So we have a lot more employment opportunities, a lot more people staying there with their families, and a lot more value based around the cause of that. Okay, the next one on there is basically you can't deal with developing your products separate from your markets. You have to basically deal with those, the development of those in tandem. If you try to do product-led marketing, you'll very often fail. If you try to develop products without having a marketing strategy, that won't work. And it's real common sense type stuff, but you would be surprised at how many people make this fatal error by just thinking because they developed something there that now they've got a viable enterprise. So you have to deal with those things. And it takes a long time. If you can see from the graphs that we have here that there's no light bulb, no light switch that you turn on and flick on and off. It's a long-term process. In Namibia's case, it's been a 40-year process to get where we are today. And then lastly, the process that we've seen, particularly on the private land in Namibia, is that the integration of wildlife and tourism into the agricultural farmlands there has really worked well in terms of risk aversion and stability of income and complementary of income. And so people, when they started promoting wildlife utilization, tourism, or trophy hunting on their private land, they didn't just immediately get rid of all their livestock. They had all their livestock there, and they started gradually, and they started building that process of promoting their wildlife products, developing their market linkages, developing a clientele base. And that process has evolved through the years where some have converted completely over to wildlife and nature-based tourism, whereas many still do multiple use where they do their livestock production and they do their complementary income around their wildlife and their tourism opportunities, whereas some still have never converted. You know, they're still back at the livestock production stage. So there's a lot of change that's still going on, but it's kind of an organic process where people look at what's suitable for them, what their comfort zone is, and very often we find the older generation of individuals, they're used to doing things the way they always did it, the way their parents taught them how to do it, and this younger generation of people, they tend to look at it and say, hey, here's an opportunity for me. And so we're now like in the second, third generation of people in Namibia that have been doing this, and those are the ones that have converted the most. Yeah. So a little bit of food for thought. One, we looked at our competitive advantages in Namibia, and I think we've tried to harness them quite well, but I'd like to ask the same question here. What are the competitive advantages of the Great Plains states? I think they're probably are some significant ones in terms of space and wild natural environments. There was the study, the 2006 U.S. Fish and Wildlife Survey on hunting, fishing, and wildlife viewing. That study found, I think it was $121 billion being generated from nature-based wildlife recreational activities in 2006, and about 87 million people participating in that. So I would think that the Great Plains states might have a few competitive advantages over your more populated states to tap into some of those markets. Again, are there policy changes that could be made in the Great Plains states in order to unlock some of the values of wildlife? Are there regulatory controls that could be altered so that people had, as a landowner, more say, more flexibility in how they used wildlife, how they benefited from wildlife, and how they could get a better market value from the linkages they could establish with marketing and promoting the wildlife on their land. Another point, the markets. They change all the time. That's what Namibia saw. And if you were to try to promote wildlife production and livestock production before 19, or not livestock, but tourism before 1970 in Namibia, you wouldn't have had a market demand for it. it would have failed. But markets change. Similarly here, is there a growing demand for organic meat? I suspect there probably is. Is there a growing demand for open spaces and getting out of the city? As we urbanize our populations across North America, our stress level goes up, and our appreciation for getting away from that tends to go up as well. And there's a willingness to pay for that experience. So how can the Great Plains states tap into that? Are there other increased demands for these biodiversity products? Again, I mentioned the meat, but I believe you find some different activities here that these products lend themselves as towards the bird viewing, guided tours, recreational visits with guides that really know the environment, that can really tell the story as only a local person can tell the story. And can you start getting people to come here to Nebraska or the Great Plains states to be part of that process? And then lastly, just some food for thought there, is what's happening in terms of our economy and our production cost. Our energy prices are going up. The cost of production for agriculture is going up. Is this going to make agriculture more viable in the long run or less viable? And on the contrary, what about our wildlife that have very little cost in terms of producing and tourism and developing that market? Is that going to become a more viable land use? So those are all different ideas and a little bit of food to think about. And that is the end of the presentation, and I would really like to thank you very much for your patience. I think it's been a little bit long, but I see people paying attention, and only heard snoring two or three times. And,